Good morning. Restrictions be damned. Let's go out. Let's go way out past the county line, out to sea, to visit a maybe mythical island.
That really is a beautiful sound from the humpback whales. I think that's one of my favourite flotillas.
Yeah, me too. And I think we should follow them because they're on their northerly migration and they're going to go up through the Pacific right up to the equator and then around the Galapagos Islands. So I think we should go up there and hang out with them and just have a break, take in the sights there. And then we should follow their wake north, somewhere into the northern hemisphere, because they're looking for a place where I've always wanted to go, and I'm convinced it's out there somewhere, and the humpback whales can find it, because I think they're going to High Brazil. You know, it only comes out of the fog banks for one day every 7 years, but I'm sure the whales know it's the right time, so I think we should follow them up there and see if it appears out of the mist. The thing I love about that sound is that it really is the sound of quite a, you know, we're in a very strange place, and that is a very strange, haunting, quite discomforting song. And you can imagine hearing that coming out of the fog and then seeing those large grey shapes, mermaid-style shapes, lolling around on the rocks. You would, if you'd been at sea for some time, it was a place you'd think about investigating. As soon as you got close to those rocks in a wooden ship, you would find yourself wrecked. And those that survived would be standing on the shore, much as we are now.
Chris Watson and Luke Clancy travelling to islands real and imagined as part of this week's Drama on One. And if you're feeling cooped up and hemmed in, and which of us isn't, it's a beautiful listen. But returning reluctantly to terra firma, it's COVID-19 time. Because last Sunday night, as you were getting that Glenroe feeling as Monday morning loomed, mic drop, it was level 5 for all. Maybe.
Whatever about people's surprise at this recommendation, there's no doubt that there are lots of people last night and this morning who are upset and very worried about what's coming next.
Indeed we were, and of course we now know what was coming next. The government chose to keep NPHET's advice on file and went for level 3 all round. Now the who knew what when game would kick in later in the week, but on Monday morning it was still all to play for and rather tense with it. Claire Byrne spoke to Professor Sam McConkie from the Royal College of Surgeons.
Is the rationale there, Sam, for this country to move to level 5 across the board?
My view is that we need to take dramatic action quickly to prevent the gradual ongoing rise in cases, not just in Dublin, but in the last few weeks in all the other 25 countries. And it's not even a case of whether we do this or not, in my view. If we don't do it now, we'll be doing it in 2 or 4 weeks when you have more people in hospital and more deaths. As you announced at the beginning, we could wait for 900 people to be hospitalised rather than the 150 we have now, and that would probably replicate then the number of deaths and chaos that we had back in March and April. But the sensible medium and long-term strategy for the economy and for all of us is to jump earlier to prevent this disease spreading in our community much earlier rather than waiting for the bad situation back then. It's not that our health system is deficient, as Danny suggests. It's that this pandemic will overwhelm any health system if you don't control it with prevention.
And with an opposing view, Dan O'Brien, Chief Economist at the Institute of International and European Affairs.
We are in a minefield now. Any way we step, we risk stepping on a mine. If the government were to close down the economy as it did in the springtime, we would send hundreds of thousands of people out of work. Now, let's be very clear about something. Within 9 months, the government could run out of money. Who is going to pay the doctor's salaries if that happens? exactly 10 years ago from right now, the government of the day was taking out a begging bowl to get an international bailout. Now, we are heading in that direction again. No other European country is shutting down its entire economy again, because that is grossly disproportionate to what's happening. We are in a very, very risky situation now. We need to take great care about shutting down the economy again and sending us back into the territory of bailouts.
The by now somewhat familiar arguments balancing public health and people's livelihoods. But just what had changed so dramatically on Sunday night to cause Neffert to hit the big red level 5 button? The modelling data hadn't changed that much, so might a certain someone's return have had anything to do with it?
So they changed. Obviously, Tony Houlihan came back on board. He appears to have called this Neffert meeting yesterday, which came as a surprise, I think, to all the politicians. It went on for a long time. They obviously thrashed it out. There must be blood on the floor in Neffert, actually, because it's so stark what's after happening.
George Lee on Drive Time. Blood on the floor? Maybe. Surprise politicians? Well, the week would tell its own tale. This is what the texters thought.
It was exaggerated. They said level 5 so people would be more accepting of level 3. Makes perfect sense. Patrick says, though, if your loved one can't get an ICU bed in a few weeks' time, you will know who to blame. And very starkly, Elizabeth says, God help us, we will suffer. Thank you, Dr. Holohan. You tried.
Oh, golly. Was the honeymoon over? In any event, for the very first time, Neffert's advice and recommendations had been kind of ignored. On Tuesday, Minister for Health Stephen Donnelly spoke to Gavin on Morning Ireland.
This is a watershed moment, Minister. The government rejecting the advice of its top public health doctors. So what's your plan? I mean, there are around 30 odd free ICU beds this morning, 39 on Sunday night. I'm not sure how many this morning, with the virus continuing to spread and escalating. How many beds do you need to have left before you rethink your plan? How many more deaths before you change your mind?
So the surge capacity that the HSE can bring on online quickly is north of 300 ICU beds. And over a two-year period, we're looking for a very substantial increase, as I said. But let's remember, Gavin, that at the height of this, when there were many times more people in hospital and many times more ICU admissions, we didn't come close to needing all of the ICU capacity that the HSE had put in place. That was the reality then. It's also worth bearing in mind that of the tragically many men and women who've lost their lives to this virus in Ireland, a very small percentage of them ever go anywhere near intensive care.
It's a big gamble, Minister. What if you're wrong? Will you take responsibility?
Well, is it a gamble, Gavin? We've been provided with advice. We've taken that advice.
You've rejected it.
We've looked at all of the evidence. And we've made what we believe is the best decision on behalf of the country. That's what the Irish government has done from day one. It's what every government around the world is doing.
Yes.
We are dealing with a global pandemic the likes of which no one has ever seen before. Every country in the world is having to make very serious decisions, which come at a very serious cost.
Minister for Health Stephen Donnelly on Tuesday's Morning Ireland. But are we really as fatigued by all of these restrictions as so many people say? Well, yes and no. Here's behavioural economist with the ESRI, Dr. Pete Lunn, on Drive Time.
We have very detailed tracking data that goes every week right back to the start of this crisis. And we also have some other sources of evidence as well. What is clear looking at that is that if anything, compliance with guidance has been edging up in recent weeks, and noticeably so, but actually has been climbing since a low point sometime around July. So the public, in fact, have not been getting complacent. They've been consistently getting more and more nervous over a period of weeks and months. And it's been the case for some time now that the majority of the public actually wanted an increase in restrictions, not fewer restrictions.
Does that surprise you? And I wonder, were we all taken in by the narrative, as I say, in public discourse, people saying, look, we know you're tired and frustrated by the restrictions. Actually, what you're saying in your research is that there's a silent majority in the country. They mightn't be vocal, but they're saying we want more restrictions. Is that right?
Yes, but two things can be true here. There's no inevitability that people becoming tired and fatigued means they will necessarily go out and start refusing to comply with these restrictions in some way. There's no definite link there. Now, it doesn't come as a surprise to me, but only because I've been following this data for, you know, every week for months on end. I think if you were to follow the public discourse, which is overwhelmingly led by people that are representing different minorities that are really suffering from this disease, then you would get the impression that there's a huge public clamor to get these restrictions even further lifted or not to put any more restrictions on, because those are the voices that you primarily hear. So yes, you're right. There's a silent majority out there that want to see sterner restrictions. Now, I would say we don't measure how much stronger those restrictions might be that the public would like to see. So, I mean, there's no indication they necessarily wanted to jump straight to level five. But for some time now, it has been the case that the majority want more restrictions.
Interesting. But if you are in that majority hankering after more restrictions, you'll just have to content yourself with level three for the moment anyway, because as of yesterday, that is where we remain. But is that caution a direct result of this week's tensions? Here's Dr. Colm Henry, Chief Clinical Officer with the HSE, who spoke to Áine Lawler on Morning Ireland.
Just riddle me this. If NPHET was so worried that they recommended level five at the weekend, but yesterday they recommended level three when the numbers are worse, and we know that, you know, people like yourself and Dr. Tony Hoolan and Philip Nolan, they're even more concerned. What does that mean? That you've bowed to political pressure?
No, NPHET is charged with looking at the trends. It's charged with giving the best public health advice. And it's not just public health experts who are in NPHET. We have people with backgrounds in general practice, in geriatric medicine. My own specialty is, although there as chief clinical officer as well, people with a background in other specialties, infectious disease. So we look at the figures, we look at the trends. And to be absolutely honest, we're very worried. We are seeing escalating numbers of cases, now over 40,000 confirmed cases in Ireland since our first case, mm-hmm. which seemed so long ago at the end of February. And this morning or last evening, 172 patients in acute hospitals with COVID. These numbers are rising exponentially. The cases, the numbers, the 2-week instance that we talk about is now 116. That was two in July, two per 100,000.
So does that not prove to you that level three isn't working so far?
Well, NPHET gives us advice to government, and government have a much broader consideration, and that has always been the tight governance there. What I would say is that we are at a crux now. Level three or level four or level five, what matters is we have a tiniest of windows now to stop this reaching levels where there'll be unsustained pressure on our hospitals, where it'll seep through into the most vulnerable of settings, which we're already seeing in terms of outbreaks. 10 outbreaks the past week in nursing homes with 68 cases. We're catching them earlier because of a higher level of awareness, but there's no sense that the virus is any less virulent than it was back in March and April.
Dr. Colm Henry of the HSE on Morning Ireland. And if you want to know how best to conduct yourself over the weekend, here's Dr. Mary Favier of NPHET and President of the Irish College of GPs on yesterday's News at One.
We're on level three, the whole country, but it's about really level three plus, you know, plus plus. Level three, like we mean it. And so we need to ask people to think about doing maybe one thing less this weekend. And if in fact, for if you can, act like it's level five.
Dr. Mary Favier, so level three or level five, or perhaps the much forgotten level four. Pick one and stick to it. And as for that spat between Taoiseach the Leo Varadkar and Dr. Tony Hoolahan, well, here's Oliver Callan.
You're through to the voicemail of Dr. Tony Hoolahan. I can't get to the phone right now as I'm trying to perform emergency surgery to remove a knife from my back. Leave a message.
Zeptones, Co-Thiche here. Just wanted to say that even though I humiliated you on national television, I hope we can still work together. I mean, I humiliate Micheál Martin every week and he puts up with it all. Anyway, just to say I continue to have confidence in you, just not your advice. And BTW, your voicemail is wrong. Didn't stab you in the back. Stabbed you in the front. Co-Thiche out.
Back in a bit. Welcome back. On Sunday, Miriam spoke to former state pathologist Dr. Mary Cassidy. She's just written her memoir, Beyond the Tape. And by her own admission, bedside manner, not exactly her thing. Basically, if you have a pulse, she's not the doc for you.
You know, for 6 years, you're getting a taster of what medicine could be like. Mm. This is what would happen if you were doing obstetrics. And I was going, oh, my God, no, 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 no. I can't be doing with that. Pregnant women and babies, because I don't like children. I'm not very good with children. I get very, twitchy when children are about. How my two children survived, I do not know. Probably because I wasn't there most of the time. So I was just busy sort of crossing things off my list again. And I was thinking, what on earth am I fit to do in this? And over a period of time, it came to me that probably I was not best suited to be working with patients face-to-face.
Especially not children.
Oh, no. When I was doing paediatrics, even the consultant said to me, Mary, don't even consider this. And I said, oh, don't worry. I'm not considering it. I was the only medical student that you got to the end of the bed and as soon as the child saw me, would just start screaming the head off. They would go to me, you just go and sit and have a cup of tea while we examine the children. I'd go, thank you, because I don't want to go anywhere near them. So it was a process of elimination and eventually I decided that to remove myself from the patients and to remove myself meant removing myself from the top floors of the hospital into the lower floors and the dungeons away from the patients. And all I saw was a little bit in a jar and that was going to suit me.
Oh, lovely. Do eat up your egg. But it was that moment between life and death that fascinated.
Our basic role is to determine the cause of death. Now, that might seem pretty simple and straightforward, and a lot of the times it is. But it was fascinating. I was just fascinated by the innards, by what happens to people. And, you know, one minute somebody was... When I started in pathology, I was dealing only with people who died in hospital. So one minute somebody would be sitting up in bed and the next minute they'd collapse, they were dead and they were down in my waiting room. And it was just that fascination between this, the fragility between life and death and how suddenly one goes from being a living being to being non-responsive and dying. And what happens in those few seconds, few minutes, few hours, sometimes few days, that the body suddenly decides to give up? And I was just fascinated by that. So I was going from the other end. People were fascinated in how people kept, you know, keeping people alive. And I was just fascinated by what suddenly happened that person just is no longer alive. How does it happen? And I'm still fascinated by it today. And every post-mortem was different and every was a learning experience and it was just incredible.
Former state pathologist Mary Cassidy with Miriam on Sunday. And death was on the minds of Liveline callers all week. They'd been phoning Joe about getting tangled in red tape when they wanted to do things like change bills or cancel policies when a loved one had died. And Mary phoned in and this is quite the story.
I rang up and I said, I need to change the bill into my name.
Mm-hmm.
You know, I did say my husband had died, but I needed, you know, and they said, and I said, so what do I do? And they said, well, we have to speak to him. And I said, well, he's passed away, you know, and she said, yeah, but we need authority, right? So I said, oh, I know what this is going to be, you know, stupid. So I said, hold on a minute, please, and I'll get him.
Okay.
I said, now he's quite sick. So we make your conversation brief. So that was fine, no problem. So okay. I waited a couple of seconds and then I came on and I said, hello? And they said, is that Mr. Moody? Is it okay if your wife takes over your account and talks on your behalf? Yeah, no problem. So I said, and they said, fine. So it was just unbelievable. I was actually laughing at the time because... And I said, I'll make this easy on myself and I pretend I'm not.
Oh, that is classic. Fair play to you, Mary. That was Liveline yesterday. Now, although all our energy is focused on the pandemic, our climate emergency has not gone away. On Mooney Goes Wild, director of the National Botanic Gardens, Matthew Jebb, discussed a Kew Gardens report which showed that within the next 50 years, a whopping 40% of our plants are at risk of extinction. And we haven't even begun to get to grips with the plants we do have.
One of the interesting things is we still don't know how many species of plant there are in the world. Every year, we're adding 2,000 new species, but only 10% of the entire world's flora of flowering plants, which is 350,000 species of plant, only 10% of that do we have an accurate idea of how severely threatened they are. Up in the botanic gardens, we have some species of plant that are already extinct in the wild, but we're growing them in captivity. In fact, we have one species in our palm house, and he is the sole remaining individual of his species. Now, he's been replicated around the world because plants can be propagated in an extraordinary way, but he's only a male. There is no female left of that species of cycad. So plants are threatened, and yet every day we are using them. Tables, buildings are made of wood. Breakfast, most of the food we're eating comes from a plant that has grown somewhere. And there are only so many species of edible plant on this planet. And their wild relatives are threatened with extinction. Plants that we don't even have a scientific name for yet are probably going extinct.
And I'm afraid one island leads the field here, and no one wants that prize.
The absolute sort of poster child for this is Hawaii. Hawaii in the middle of the Pacific, 100 species of plant have gone extinct. And we know from historic evidence that these plants are not to be found anywhere in Hawaii. 200 species of plant on Hawaii are only known by less than 50 individuals. So of the total flora of about 1,200, 300 are either extinct already or about to go extinct. So this is a very sobering fact. And something like Hawaii, like an island, tells us a great deal about what is going to happen in the future. Because if I went to the Brazilian rainforest and I cut down a patch of forest...
Well, you better go quick.
Yeah, well, exactly.
Before they burn it down completely.
Well, you know, once you've cut down a huge quantity of forest, that you might left 1 square kilometre and you've chopped down 9. Well, all the species of plant and animal are probably still left in that 1 kilometre, but their population level is now microscopic. It's 1/10 of what it should be. And for some species of bird, especially big raptors, predators, they won't have enough territory to feed on their prey anymore. So they will go extinct. So there's a lag time. So we might commit the atrocities that we have to the biological world. We have exterminated almost 50% of the standing crop of biodiversity on Earth. Populations are very, very low. And during this lag phase, things reach a new equilibrium, which unfortunately is extinction for a lot of species.
Lord, that was Dr. Matthew Jebb on Mooney Goes Wild. But on Wednesday, the government published their Climate Action Bill, which set out the aim of carbon neutrality by 2050. And this plan was to be legally binding. So maybe, just maybe, it will work. Paul Cunningham, however, sounded a world-weary note when he spoke on Drive Time.
It's a shocking thing to say, but 20 years ago I was there as Noel Dempsey was devising Ireland's first national climate change strategy. And within 6 or 7 years, I think around the year 2008, he said it had been a failure. And the reason why was that while the cabinet would unite around a strategy, once he as minister went around to individual departments saying, you've got to do this and you've got to do that, they all found a reason to block him. So this idea of a new plan, a 30-year plan, locking in this government and successive governments into a plan which is legally binding, I think that's how they're going to try and short circuit the problems they've had before and get to a place which is carbon neutral.
Oy, oy, oy. Nevertheless, when environmental journalist John Gibbons spoke later on Late Debate, he was in no doubt that this was the issue that would determine everything.
Brexit was an emergency. It continues to be an emergency. COVID is an emergency. It will continue to be an emergency. But all of these are completely put in the halfpenny place by the climate emergency. Now, unfortunately, some people don't accept that and have basically worked hard over the last 10 years and more, as long as I'm at it and longer, to spread doubt, confusion, misinformation and basically saying, oh, we can't do this, we can't do that, you'll ruin rural Ireland, you'll do this, that and the other. And it's a shame because we've lost a decade and more in time that we could have been solving this problem, that we could have been getting Ireland climate ready. Now, you take, say, our EU targets from 2005 to 2020. We were given a very easy target, much easier, say, for example, than some other countries. We were just told we need to get our emissions down by 20% in that period. Now, Ireland incorporated in that period managed approximately, at best, 1%. Some sectors like agriculture actually went up by 8% since 2012. So we have a situation where we're given these targets, we're told we have to do them, and people say, ah, sure, that's not really real. That's not real Ireland. There, you know, and this notion, this very insidious idea that climate is something being imposed on us by people from Dublin or people from Europe, people who don't really understand Ireland, is just so unfortunate because, I mean, for example, last month, September 2020, was the hottest September ever recorded on the instrumental record in 140 years. Now, the second hottest September ever recorded in 140 years was September 2019. 4 million acres of California are in flames. The Arctic is at its second lowest ever ice. We've got massive wildfires across Siberia and into the Arctic Circle. We are in a global climate emergency.
Bigger than the global pandemic? Katie Hannan asked the question.
To be fair, the COVID crisis is hardly small stuff.
It's not small stuff, Katie, but where did COVID come from, right? COVID, we know now COVID is a zoonotic disease, meaning that it jumped from wild animals into humans. Why did it jump from wild animals? What science has been able to tell us is that human impacts and deforestation and taking away the habitats of wild animals is forcing the viruses that they live in to find a new host. And guess who that is? That's us. We can expect more zoonotic diseases over the next 5, 10, 15 years.
None of this was good. That was a frightening proposition, John Gibbons on Late Debate. And I think we need a bit of this. Oh, defy you not to swivel just a little bit. Tight jeans, mullets, MTV-tastic Van Halen. And Eddie Van Halen died on Tuesday night. And on Wednesday, Ryan Tuberty let rip on the guitar solo by way of Monaster Evan.
For me, sometimes guitar solos... I kind of looked at that. Sometimes guitar... Careful now. I guess I'm getting a few... Careful now. Here's what I'll say about a guitar solo. I'm enjoying a song. It's going great. And then your man comes out with the hair and the guitar, right? Not him necessarily. I'm just saying. I love Brian May, but just sometimes you're thinking, just let Freddie have this. Just let him have the song, you know? And sometimes a guitar solo... What I would say, I often use this sometimes when people divert. It's like you're going to Cork and somebody says, I have to pull into Monaster Evan. Don't pull into Monaster Evan. Just get to Cork. So I think sometimes a guitar solo is pulling into Monaster. I'm just sometimes. And then maybe it's not so much. Maybe you have to go to Monaster Evan, A, because it's beautiful, and B, because you want to, pull in. like Michael Jackson decided to pull in to Monaster Evan, did he not? When he decided to ask Eddie Van Halen, this metaphor is way out of control. But anyway, he asked Eddie Van Halen to maybe help him get the petrol in the local station. And then we have the Beat It solo. Pretty good. Now, in fairness, let's all go to Monaster Evan for a few minutes with that one.
Oh, poor old Monaster Evan. But fast forward later to Arena and guitarist Ray Harmon, who spelled out exactly why Eddie Van Halen was no detour.
I know you guitar players now love to noodle and love to get caught up in techniques and all the rest of it. But for the layman, could you tell us, in terms of technicalities, what was it that Eddie Van Halen did that people weren't doing previous to that? People talk about the tapping technique, but it wasn't so much that he invented that, but it was what he did with it. Tapping being using your left hand to hit the neck of the guitar rather than strumming or using a plectrum down in the body or at the neck, at the bridge of the guitar.
Yeah, it's almost like he wanted to play the guitar like a piano in that sense. He wanted to use the fretboard more. So it is a really difficult thing to do. It's incredibly difficult to do. There were loads of people doing it already. I mean, Paganini was doing it on violins and guitars. And I think, like, even just in the 60s and 70s, there were a lot more bands doing it, like Canned Heat. And he would have seen those playing in L.A. and the Whiskey and so on. So he would have been aware of the technique. He would have been practicing at his home. But he just somehow consolidated it into this amazing, powerful band. So tapping was one thing. He had this incredible technique where he held his plectrum between his thumb and his middle finger as opposed to his first finger, so that he left his first finger to tap. He also had an incredibly fast tremolo with his right hand, which is another thing. So he was one of the first people to dip his pickups in wax to stop feedback and so on. And he even owned some patents for guitar hardware.
Yeah, so there was all that technical, as you said, the noodling side of things that he liked as well.
Ooh, noodling at the highest level. I do love it when Sean gets technical on us. That was Eddie Van Halen, remembered on Arena. Back in a bit. Welcome back. Limerick's having a bit of a moment when it comes to hip-hop. Arnie Gallagher and Culturefile spoke to some of the people behind PX Music.
Grab your wellies for the flood that's coming. You know me, always up to something. Say, grab your wellies for the flood that's coming. You know me, always up to something. I was up in a heap, half asleep. You should have seen me running 100 meter sprints all around the TV. You don't believe me? You really don't believe me?
Content-wise with the music, what kind of stuff are you guys writing about then? What are you trying to say?
We all get most of our inspiration from the crusty socks you leave under your bed, like, do you know what I mean? Like, as in, like, no, but, like, it's like ripping the wallpaper off the inside of your brain and seeing what picks up. We all kind of write, not negatively, but very cynically anyway, I would say we all kind of write, and I think that's very telling of, like, where we're from or what we're brought up around and stuff like that, like, do you know what I mean? But I'm the heartbroken fella, and I do this. Do you know what I mean? Like, I write the soft, like, soft tunes. Gavin writes, like, between tunes about worrying about family members sleeping out in the roads, and then tunes about being off your game somewhere. That dirt under your under your fingernails. Like, do you know what I mean? You're probably finding it hard better. It's an unorganised. It's an organised. Is it an organised mess or an unorganised? I don't know what way to. Yeah, it's organised chaos. That's slightly it, yeah. Organized. Slightly organised kind of chaos.
It just pans out. No one really gets badly hurt.
Basically, yeah.
But don't you might, a pint glass might come out of somewhere. Remember Jack Bradley got a pint glass out of nowhere. Someone threw a pint glass.
Pint glass.
The best of Limerick hip-hop as heard on Culturefile. August over on Bioware Egan, Shun, Sinead and Anya were in New York in the 70s with a case of disco fever.
Night fever, night fever. Oh, you know how to show it.
Tagam ishtach, pair of flares or them. Gochrod or.
Yeah.
Slinky.
So, can Lien
Shachto do with Erin?
Okay, my dear Shachto.
Gur Bunny Radin Resta, don't know. Oh, my lesson.
Never force a gaze to the
Oh, and even
Marlock Coskin or
no.
Venture in Palo, yes, a winner.
Venture in Chicago.
Chicago.
Venture Club Eha.
Man, Studio 54 shooting.
Yeah, I guess I'd just be breaking it down. I guess.
Bjorn Regan on the boogie, Jay Saharn. And Ray Darcy too hit the dance floor yesterday in the company of writer and director Rupert Everett.
The new film is it's about me on an exchange trip in Paris in the late 1970s.
Right.
And it's got disco, it's got fashion, it's got transsexuals, it's got escort work, it's got drugs, it's got everything.
Because you loved that. You probably do still love it. But like you love dressing up.
I love dressing up.
Yeah. Mm. Still?
Only till the age of 16. I love dressing up. I dressed up as... From the age of 5 to 16, I loved dressing up as a girl. And at school, I played all the girls' parts in the plays. And on Saturdays, me and my best friend would dress up in girls' outfits and pretend to be sisters of boys. And we'd go and watch the rugby. And we loved doing this until a group of sixth formers cottoned on to our weekly plans, and they ambushed us, and they chased us. Our school was in this valley, a monastery, and they chased us all over this valley, through the forest, through the lakes, and we ended up climbing a tree to hide from them with our knickers all broken and our dresses in shreds. And the weird thing about it was, we loved it. That's what I still can't quite understand. We got home flushed with success.
So not only did you like being a girl, you liked being chased by boys as a girl.
We loved it. We were so excited. And when we got up the tree, we were stifling our laughter so that they wouldn't hear us. But it was actually quite scary looking back.
Quite the image. Rupert Everett with Ray. President Donald Trump seems to be recovering rather well from COVID-19, so far anyway. And on Morning Ireland, Washington correspondent Brian O'Donovan described the Donald's journey back to the White House.
Donald Trump walked out of Walter Reed Hospital and boarded the presidential helicopter Marine One. He then flew 10 minutes across Washington and arrived at the White House. He ascended the steps and then he stopped on the Truman balcony. He removed his mask, posed for photos, waving, saluting, giving the thumbs up. He then went inside the White House and recorded a video which he posted to social media.
Don't be afraid of it. You're going to beat it. We have the best medical equipment. We have the best medicines, all developed recently. And you're going to beat it. I went, I didn't feel so good. And 2 days ago, I could have left 2 days ago. 2 days ago, I felt great, like better than I have in a long time. I said just recently, better than 20 years ago. Don't let it dominate. Don't let it take over your lives. And I know there's a risk, there's a danger, but that's okay. And now I'm better, and maybe I'm immune. I don't know.
However, when Claire spoke to WHO envoy Dr. David Nabarro, he was a bit less gung-ho.
Remember this, everybody. COVID is not a trivial illness, whatever you might read people saying.
So then, did you have your head in your hands when you heard President Donald Trump saying, don't be afraid of the virus?
I personally wish that leaders wouldn't make that sort of comment, yeah.
Oh, ever the diplomat, and all that before President Trump said that he felt getting COVID-19 was a blessing from God. There you have it. I'm not quite sure Sarah Jane, who called into Joe, feels quite the same way, though. She and her entire family were restricting their movements. Just have a listen to this.
I'm COVID positive for the last 14 days. Okay. And unfortunately, two of my children tested COVID positive as well, alongside. Okay. My family have been in isolation. I have six children altogether. Right. And my family have been separated now for the last 2 weeks. My children are being retested today at 3 o'clock. Okay. If any of them were to be negative, we all go back into isolation again. So potentially my situation could be weeks of isolation. I've been in the sitting room for 14 days. My two children joined me then after they were tested positive. My husband is working from home, and my eldest son, he's isolated in his bedroom. My other son, who's 13, he's isolated in his bedroom. And then I have two 10-year-old and an 8-year-old as well that are isolated, and bless them, in the extension together all day. Like, my husband knocks on the door in the morning, leaves the breakfast outside. I get it with a mask on. Then to get to the bathroom, we wear masks, go back and forth from the bathroom, and we let my husband know we've been in that area. And then no one else is allowed to pass through the hallway for a couple of hours. And We've done the best we can, and so far so good.
Oh, that cannot be easy. That was Sarah Jane on Liveline. However, for a certain Aisling, and I don't quite know how to put this, all things COVID, well, not an absolute disaster. The creators behind the Aisling books, Emer McLysett and Sarah Breen, talked to Ryan Tuberty about how their culture in the city was positively cradling her hand sanitizer.
She would be very helpful, especially in these unprecedented times.
Would she say in these unprecedented times quite a lot?
Absolutely. Yeah. In every email, in every text.
Hope the email finds you well.
Yeah, in these strange times. Yeah. And then fill in favour request here.
Yeah. Yeah, here we are in the new normal. Yeah, she's been cycling through the sayings
and is she
updating them as she goes along.
Is she, these the new normal and all this? Is she getting a kind of a weird euphoric anti-kick from the whole thing?
I mean, I don't know if you're allowed to say she would be thriving, but she would be thriving in these times.
In what respect?
It's because there's so many rules, Ryan. And the rules are so black and white, like it's so clear that you have to stay 2 metres away from somebody else. Like Aisling would find that very easy to do. And it's all about helping people as well, isn't it? So every time you put your mask on, it's not just for yourself. You're showing your community, I am helping you too.
Yes.
So that's why when she sees the nose hanging out,
yes,
she is absolutely offended by it.
She's doing her nut, is she?
It's
the nostrils are just too much.
Every time she sees it, we call it nose willying, because the nose is willying out over the mask.
Very good.
Every time she sees that, a few minutes are shaved off her life because she's just tutting and sighing.
So does she tut and confront, or tut and walk on?
Behind the mask.
Yeah, tutting and walking on.
Oh, so she doesn't. She won't go up and say, excuse me.
She might do it with her eyes, but she wouldn't be fond of confrontation. I mean, I'm the same. I'm muttering things behind my mask constantly.
Oh, I've been glaring. I'm like, I don't know if I'm communicating sufficiently with my eyes if people aren't wearing their mask properly. I'm like, oh, I have to work on my glare.
And is she virtue signalling a bit these days, or is she just getting on with the rules? And would she be a big fan of Dr. Houlihan now?
Oh God, yeah.
Like, would he be like nearly a poster in the bedroom material?
Yeah, she's thought about buying one of those kind of graphic design posters of him and maybe putting him up in the hall or something.
And why does she like him so much?
He's just very comforting.
Yeah. Very matter of fact. She hangs on his every word.
Yeah, we're making her sound like an awful dry.
I'm talking about myself here. Yeah.
there's an awful lot, but you know, she sees him as a pater familias, this lovely father figure who is kind of a comfort blanket on
the
news.
Yeah, and
he's
so authoritative. He knows what he's talking about. And he just wants everyone to be well, and that's how she feels as well. Somebody on Twitter a while ago actually said that Aisling is the good in all of us, and that really warmed my cockles because it's so true.
Yeah.
Oh, that's quite lovely. That was Emer McLysett and Sarah Breen yesterday. Well, that is almost it for this week's playback. We did mention a bit of the hip hop here in Ireland, so we'll finish on that. Thanks for listening. Talk to you next week.